This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, the 3rd of March, 2011. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood. Coming up on the newscast. In Iran, the fate of two opposition leaders remains uncertain as the government crackdown on dissent continues. Ohio's Senate passes a bill that restricts collective bargaining rights. And on Capitol Hill, elected officials move forward with some changes to the new healthcare law. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. U.S. Army Private First Class Bradley Manning is now facing 22 additional charges related to allegations that he leaked classified information to WikiLeaks. One of his alleged leaks is a video from a U.S. Army helicopter showing it opening fire on several men in Iraq, two of them Reuters journalists. One of the charges he faces is aiding the enemy, a capital offense. Salon legal analyst Glenn Greenwald told Democracy Now! This morning that this raises the question of who the enemy is. It's either WikiLeaks or...
By disseminating this information to WikiLeaks and other news organizations that ultimately published it, it enabled the Taliban and Al-Qaeda to read this information and to access it, which would basically mean that any kind of leak now of classified information to newspapers where your intent is not to aid the Taliban or help them but to expose wrongdoing is now considered a capital offense and considered aiding and abetting the enemy in essence. And that's an amazingly broad and expansive definition of what that offense would be.
Prosecutors have not indicated that they will seek the death penalty. 23-year-old Bradley Manning is currently being held in a military prison in Quantico, Virginia, under Prevention of Injury Watch. Many advocates have complained that the conditions of his imprisonment violate his human rights. Manning's lawyer, David Coombs, predicts Manning's trial date will be set for early June. More than 800 earthquakes have hit Arkansas since September, including a powerful 4.7 magnitude quake felt throughout the state last weekend. In looking for possible causes, officials with the Arkansas Oil and Gas Commission say they found a possible correlation between the seismic activity and hydraulic fracturing, or natural gas fracking operations in the state. As FSRN's Malcolm Glover reports, an emergency meeting is scheduled for tomorrow.
Oil and gas officials are considering shutting down two injection wells that have been linked to a sharp increase in earthquakes in north-central Arkansas. The wells are used by the natural gas industry to transport wastewater used in the fracking process. Shane Corey, deputy director of the State Oil and Gas Commission, says preliminary geological test results are a deciding factor.
We believe there is a potential correlation between injection operations in one or both of these two specific wells with the seismic activity in the area. That evidence will be presented by us and by the Geological Survey at Friday's hearing.
Corey says the companies, Chesapeake Operating Incorporated and Clarita Operating LLC, can present their own evidence at the hearing. Chesapeake Energy says it believes its wells are safe. A moratorium on new wastewater wells was put in place January to give scientists until midsummer to study any possible links to earthquake activity. Malcolm Glover, FSRN, Little Rock.
Violence continued today in Ivory Coast, where 11 Alassane Ouattara supporters were shot dead during a women's march. Reuters reports that men in uniform, assumed to be supporters of Laurent Gbagbo, arrived at the protest in trucks, then opened fire on the participants. Gbagbo still refuses to cede power, even though Ouattara won an internationally recognized election. Several international radio stations have been taken off the air, including, says the BBC, its own broadcast, and power and water has been shut off to the northern part of the country, the seat of support for Ouattara. Protesters in Cairo have been calling for the resignation of Prime Minister Ahmed Shafik. Today, just hours ahead of a planned mass sit-in in Tahrir Square, the country's armed forces announced the politician has been replaced. Aya Batraoui has more from Egypt.
Opposition groups and activists expressed initial approval of the Egyptian Armed Forces appointment of Issam Sharaf as the country's new prime minister. Sharaf, who replaced the controversial Ahmed Shafik, has a good reputation and was seen taking part in anti-government protests prior to the resignation of Hosni Mubarak. Sharaf, an engineering professor with a PhD from Purdue University, had served previously as a minister of transport under Mubarak for less than 2 years. He resigned from the post after a deadly train accident. Egypt's largest opposition, the Muslim Brotherhood, told FSRN they believe Sharaf left the ministry because, quote, either he wasn't happy with corruption or wasn't practicing it, so those in charge weren't happy with him. The youth-led April 6 movement told FSRN they were pleased with Sharaf's appointment because he's been on the side of the revolution from the beginning. He is now tasked with forming a new cabinet. Activists will now wait to see if he responds to their demands and purges all of Mubarak's appointed ministers. Aya Batraoui, FSRN, Cairo.
The UN says it is concerned about the safety of 45 people arrested 2 weeks ago in Zimbabwe for attending a discussion about the pro-democracy movements in northern Africa. They have been charged with treason and face a possible death penalty. Among those arrested was University of Zimbabwe lecturer and meeting organizer Munyaradzi Gwesai. He told local media that many of those arrested have been beaten, lashed, and tortured for information about the meeting. An initial trial is expected to begin next week. And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Danny Wood in San Francisco. In Libya, news reports say there were airstrikes this morning on the oil town of Brega, where yesterday army units allied with the opposition repelled attacks from Gaddafi's forces. And the Dutch government has confirmed that three of its soldiers helping to evacuate civilians have been captured by pro-Gaddafi forces. Today, President Obama said the US is putting in place what he called unprecedented sanctions and responding to the urgent humanitarian needs of tens of thousands of people who are fleeing Libya.
I have therefore approved the use of US military aircraft to help move Egyptians who have fled to the Tunisian border to get back home to Egypt. I've authorized USAID to charter additional civilian aircraft to help people from other countries find their way home. I've also directed USAID to send humanitarian assistance teams to the Libyan border so that they can work with the United Nations, NGOs, and other international partners inside Libya to address the urgent needs of the Libyan people.
The International Criminal Court has announced an investigation into alleged crimes against humanity committed by Gaddafi and members of his regime. Unrest also continues in Iran. Human rights advocates are demanding Iranian authorities provide information about the whereabouts of former presidential candidates Mir Hossein Mousavi and Mehdi Karoubi. Family members reported that the leaders and their wives were taken from house arrest, but government officials have denied this. Protests continued in Tehran this week, with dozens reported arrested. This follows massive demonstrations in several Iranian cities on February the 14th. For more, we go to exiled Iranian Ahmad Fatemi in Sweden. He's co-founder of Mission Free Iran and a member of the International Federation of Iranian Refugees. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
What's the latest your contacts in Iran are telling you about the current situation of Hossein Mousavi and Mehdi Karoubi?
The latest I heard was that they were allowed to visit their immediate family members.
And so do we know that they are actually in jail, because the Iranian authorities have even been denying that? Do you know where they are exactly?
Yeah, well, we don't know exactly because the authorities have not mentioned anything about arresting them. And this is their way of handling these issues, you know. But the information which comes from Iran indicates that they have been arrested, yeah.
And what about their wives and families? Because there were some reports that their wives had also been detained.
That's the same thing. Their Iranian authorities deny categorically that they have arrested these people. But again, as I told you, this is the way they do. They do their business. They prosecute, they execute people without even contacting their families. They have executed people in Iran without even giving. If you remember, Farzad Kamangar was executed May last year. A body of Farzad Kamangar has not even been released to the family. So this is the way. This government, this regime has no laws, abide by no laws, not even their own barbaric laws. So yeah, well, that is the situation, unfortunately, in Iran, yeah?
Yesterday, we heard a parliamentary panel call for firm legal action to be taken against Mousavi and Karubi. What sort of action do you think that could mean?
They are trying to indicate that whatever is happening in Iran is due to a few people, a number of people. They call them leaders of fitna, which means mayhem. This is their actually the way they want to identify this movement, the revolution in Iran, by a few people, which is totally false. This revolution has nothing to do with those people, the reformist Mousavi and Karubi. So what they are trying to do by asking for a hard-handed reaction to leaders of mayhem, which they mean by that Mousavi and Karubi, to frighten the movement, to in a way to hold their balance, political balance, with what is going on in Iran.
The reforms that Karubi and Mousavi actually want are regarded by many as very conservative. To what extent do they really represent Iran's opposition movement?
As late as 2 weeks ago, Mousavi and Karubi had an announcement saying that their objective is to revive the golden era of Khomeini. Now, this is not what Iranian people want. This is exactly what Iranian people are out there fighting and struggling against.
In spite of the efforts to deter protesters and the opposition, on Tuesday, rallies did take place and dozens were reported arrested. Can you tell us anything more about those events?
Those events actually is a continuation of what happened during 2009 after the election. Of course, these have been affected or been encouraged by what happens in the whole Middle East. The events in Iran, although a continuation of what happened in 2009, definitely has been encouraged by these events. People know that there is hope. People have seen what happened in Egypt. And, of course, this has affected the Islamic republics, too. Latest I heard today was that by the French economist media, that Iranian authorities, the leaders of this system, have started to move their wealth in a very unprecedented way to banks abroad, outside Iran. Of course, this has affected them too, and these are connected. People's mood, which was very different than before. If you follow the events in Tehran and other cities, everybody, and we had a number of reporting groups on the ground, they were saying that the mood of people was of joy, of happiness, that means that people now have a horizon in front of them, which says that this is possible, we can do it. Every Tuesday from now on, we are going to have demonstrations in Iran. The first one is March 8, the International Global Women's Day. And this has been a very, very important, significant event in Iran since 32 years ago. So this time, definitely this is going to be a different one because Iranian revolution is a woman's revolution. The most important objective of this revolution is gender equality. And this is one of those occasions that we get a chance to go out and say what we want. This is not about reform. This is about social revolution.
Ahmed Fatemi, co-founder of Mission Free Iran and a member of the International Federation of Iranian Refugees. Thanks very much for talking with Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you for having me.
Ohio's Senate has passed a bill which makes major changes to collective bargaining rights for state and local workers. Like similar legislation under consideration in Wisconsin and Indiana, the proposed law would reduce the scope of unions to bargain for their members. The bill now goes to the House, where a vote is expected next week. Sevilla Mann has more from Ohio.
Jeers could be heard from opponents as the Senate prepared to confirm its vote on Senate Bill 5, which narrowly passed 17-16. The vote came one day after a demonstration which drew the largest crowds to the Ohio State House in 15 years. The vast majority at the State House on Tuesday were there to oppose the bill, which drastically curtails collective bargaining power for state and local employees. But at Senate Bill 5's final hearing, the sponsor of the bill, Republican Senator Shannon Jones, stood firm in her views on union negotiations.
In the 27 years since public employees have been allowed to collectively bargain, these contracts have slowly clogged the arteries of state and local governments. Our cities are not making their pension payments. They are not making their workers' comp payments. They are not doing infrastructure projects. They are gutting basic services. Why? Because their hands are tied by collective bargaining agreements.
The amended bill that passed preserves employees' right to bargain for wages and hours, but ends bargaining for health insurance and most other issues of pay and ranking. It also bans strikes and ends binding arbitration for firefighters and police officers. Representatives of both those groups have said this could compromise their safety on the job, since under the new law, they can no longer demand certain kinds of equipment and know they will receive it. While the bill's supporters maintain it will save the state money, many of the bill's opponents say its real purpose is to diminish public employee unions, which are a bulwark of Democratic campaigning. Senator Shirley Smith from Cleveland spoke against the bill at its final hearing. She said Martin Luther King Jr. would have opposed the bill.
He died for people to have the right to collectively bargain. And if not for any other reason, the fact that he died in support of collective bargaining is enough for me not to support this bill. However, there are more reasons. This is a bold and speedy move to reform government without participation of the people. It is an insult to democracy, a gangster approach to change, and a direct erosion of the people's rights.
The bill might not have passed out of committee if Republicans had not removed two members who opposed the bill at the last minute and replaced them with supporters. Now that it passed the full Senate, it moves to the Republican-dominated House, which is expected to vote on the bill by March 15th. Governor John Kasich, a staunch supporter of the bill, says he will sign it into law if it passes. Sevilla Mann, Free Speech Radio News, Ohio.
Six Republicans joined Democrats in their opposition to Senate Bill 5, which passed by just one vote, 17-16. We now go to one of those Republicans, Ohio Senator Tim Grendel. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Well, it's a pleasure to talk with you.
Senator, what are your concerns about this bill?
Well, you know, I'm for collective bargaining reform. 85% of the bill was a step in the right direction, but there are provisions in the bill that greatly restrict the ability of police and fire to negotiate for their safety. Even in Wisconsin, they exempted police and fire from this kind of collective bargaining reform. And there's a provision in this bill that ultimately leaves the decision of what the employee's contract terms are going to be to the city council or the school board or the township trustees. And they are management. So essentially, we've eliminated a meaningful third-party independent decision-maker resolving disputes and giving it back to the school boards and the city councils themselves. And that just isn't a fair system. It's not consistent with due process.
I understand that one version of this bill was about 500 pages. But what actually passed yesterday? And did you have the opportunity to read it all?
Well, the original bill was 475. I read it three times. There was a 90-page amendment that came out on Monday that I read, but I did not have the ability to read the bill as it was on the floor with the incorporated amendment. We just didn't have enough time. And since this is free speech radio, there is a very, very detrimental provision in the final bill that takes away the right of a municipal worker from talking to their city councilman, or if you're a school teacher, from your school board about anything dealing with collective bargaining, or that could even be indirectly dealing with it during contract time, which I think is a violation of the First Amendment rights of free speech and assembly of the public employees.
So that's one thing you would clearly want changed, but what else needs to be changed for you to actually back this law?
Well, we need to give police and fire either an exemption from the bill or the opportunity to at least negotiate issues of safety, you know, type of things. Two police officers in a car in high crime areas, or bulletproof vests, things of that nature. And we need to fix this dispute resolution system where they replaced an independent arbitrator by making the city council or the school board themselves the binding arbitrator. We actually made a proposal where the presiding judge of the local county, who is an elected official, would make that ultimate decision, and unfortunately that amendment was rejected.
And so at this stage, how likely is it that this bill will actually get changed to your satisfaction?
Oh, I doubt it. I think there may be one or two small changes made in the Ohio House. I believe the governor will sign it, and I predict, based on Ohio history, labor will circulate petitions here in Ohio, which they have a right to do within 90 days of the bill signature, and the bill will be on the ballot either this November or next November. And based on Ohio history, the voters will reject the changes in the law, and we will unfortunately be where we are today with a defective system of collective bargaining that needs some critical improvement.
Senator Tim Grendel, one of six Republicans who voted against this Ohio bill that restricts collective bargaining and workers' rights, thanks very much for talking with Free Speech Radio News.
My pleasure. Have a great day.
As the massive labor protests in Wisconsin near the end of their third week, movements to recall politicians are heating up. Recall campaigns for every eligible Republican state senator were filed yesterday. Five Democratic state senators are also facing recall campaigns. Organizers are also laying the groundwork to recall Governor Walker. Molly Stentz from Wirt FM in Madison has the story.
Michael Brown wants to do what has never been done before in Wisconsin: recall the governor. He's a single dad from Appleton, an independent voter, and after weeks of massive statewide protests over the governor's budget bill, he said he's had enough. He's launched United Wisconsin, a grassroots group campaigning to replace the holder of the state's highest elected office. He's got a website and a database, and so far, 75,000 supporters.
This is about removing Scott Walker, removing Rebecca Clayfish in their extreme views, and putting someone in there who will listen. Now, whoever is in there, I want them to be bipartisan. I want them to listen to the left. I want them to listen to the right, because that is what democracy is. Democracy is negotiating.
The governor cannot be recalled until he's been in office for a year, and it'll take 500,000 signatures to force a special election. Until that time, though, outraged Wisconsin citizens have targeted state senators who've been in office at least one term. Milwaukee resident Patrick Williams has started WisconsinRecall.net for exactly that purpose.
We do not deserve this from our leaders. Nobody deserves this. We have to be governed in unity and in fairness and with a spirit of negotiation and compromise. So those are the kinds of values that we think should be in government. And if we can't have those, and if this mean-spirited way of attempting to govern is going to prevail, we're going to recall the folks. We're going to do everything we can to recall the folks within the bounds of the law.
Half the Senate is eligible for recall this year, and petitions have been filed in nearly every eligible district. Each Senate recall campaign requires 15,000 to 20,000 signatures to launch a special election. Now that the campaigns have been filed, the clock starts ticking. Campaigns get 60 days to collect those signatures. One person who's been collecting some of those signatures at the Capitol this week is Cabell Grothman, a graduate student at UW-Madison.
We feel that by going along with Walker's underhanded tactics, these senators have demonstrated that they are not committed to democracy in Wisconsin. They are enemies of democracy in Wisconsin. They don't care about what their constituents want either. We want to give them the opportunity to sign those recall petitions and demonstrate to those senators that what they did was not acceptable.
If the recall petitions are successful, special elections for senators could be held as early as July. A recall election for governor could be held in early 2012. Molly Stentz, FSRN, Madison.
And AP reports that the Wisconsin Senate passed a resolution today calling for police to detain the 14 Democrats who fled the state in protest of the anti-union bill. The resolution said the lawmakers are guilty of contempt. In the coming months, changes are in store for the nation's new health care law. Some are supported by the White House, but others, like a provision passed by House Republicans today, are fiercely opposed by the Obama administration. Matt Laszlo has the story from Washington.
We all know Republicans want to repeal the new health care law. That got them applause on the campaign trail, but its chances of happening are slim to none. But there are some areas where the two parties are starting to see common ground. One of those areas is repealing a section of the law that forces small businesses to send 1099 IRS forms to every vendor they pay over $600. The provision would create tedious paperwork for businesses, but would also create billions of dollars in additional tax revenue to help pay for the new health care law. Texas Republican Congressperson Jeb Hensarling heralded Thursday's vote to end that provision.
As a nation, you cannot help the job seeker by punishing the job creator.
In the initial health law, that 1099 provision was projected to reap $25 billion. To recoup that lost revenue, Republicans decided to go after people getting federal insurance subsidies. Under the law, you get a subsidy if you make less than 400% of the poverty level. The GOP bill recoups that subsidy money if a person or a family moves out of that lower tax bracket. Over 100 Democrats ended up opposing the bill because of that provision. Sandra Levin of Michigan is the top Democrat on the House Tax Writing Committee.
In very simple terms, in clear terms, in unmistakable terms, the pay for is an increase on middle income families.
Democrats like New York's Joseph Crowley say the Republican bill amounts to a tax increase.
Yes, you heard that right. It is only 59 days since my Republican colleagues have assumed majority control of the House of Representatives, and they are already breaking their campaign pledge of no new taxes, a pledge that 234 of 241 sitting Republican members of the House signed.
The bill is now stalled as the House and Senate look to work out their disagreement on how to pay for the change. But other changes may be in store for the law, too. A bipartisan group of senators have introduced legislation allowing states to opt out of the federal health mandate in 2014. That's 3 years earlier than is currently allowed. While addressing a gathering of the nation's governors, President Obama lent his support to the idea.
I think that's a reasonable proposal. I support it. It will give you flexibility more quickly while still guaranteeing the American people reform.
There's a catch with Obama's announcement, though. For the government to sign off on an alternative plan, states would have to get its approval. To get that approval, any alternative plan can't be more expensive than the current health law, and states would have to make sure that most residents obtain insurance. New Hampshire Republican Congressperson Frank Ginta says the president isn't conceding much of anything.
Well, he wants to implement his legislation no matter what. He believes that mandating and enforcing the purchase of health insurance should be the law of the land.
On the Democratic side of the aisle, New Hampshire Senator Jean Shaheen says she supports the move to give individual states more control of the health policy within its borders.
Well, you know, I was a governor, so I think states need flexibility.
Shaheen says she isn't upset that the president is now changing the law that she voted in favor of. She says from its inception, Democrats argued the law needed to evolve.
This is a starting point, recognizing that there are going to have to be changes along the way. When you're dealing with this significant a sector of the economy, you have to look at what works and what needs tweaking.
While signaling that he's open to changing parts of the law, the president also put his line in the sand.
I am not open to refighting the battles of the last 2 years or undoing the progress that we've made.
It's unclear what changes to the health care law will be able to muster the bipartisan support necessary to become law. What is clear is that the nation's debate over its health care policy is not going anywhere anytime soon. Matt Laszlo, FSRN, Washington.
And that's today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Headlines editor was Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. editor was Matt Laszlo. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Scott Pham. Thanks to KPFA, Nathan Moore, the FSRN Board and Steering Committee, and many others for relentless work to make sure FSRN stays on the air. For more information on how you can support FSRN, go to our website, fsrn.org. Thanks for listening. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood.